intensified repression against human rights defenders, especially journalists across the occupied territories. The office said the regime's measures severely undermine human rights of Palestinians, especially the right to freedom of expression. The UN Rights Office said, since October 2023, Israeli forces have killed 289 journalists in Gaza. Stress that there are strong indications that Palestinian journalists were deliberately targeted on account of their work. The office added that Israeli forces have also abducted over 200 Palestinian journalists from both Gaza and the West Bank during the past 2 years. It noted that most of the abductees are held under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy, which results in arbitrary deprivation of liberty and exposes abductees to torture and enforced disappearance. According to the UN Rights Office, at least 85 Palestinians have died in Israeli jails since October 7, 2023. It emphasized that Israel's restrictions on independent journalism are part of a broader clampdown on human rights defenders, anti-occupation activists, and civil society organization, which has intensified since the Gaza genocide began. We earlier talked to political analyst and investigative journalist Tony Gosling. He explained how the Western media have been in collusion with Israeli forces in the killings of Gaza journalists.
The journalists have been specifically and individually targeted to be killed because they are in an area which is a chaotic place, a terrible place where atrocities are taking place, and it's simply that the Israeli government doesn't want the world to see these things. We've got a lot of technology now. We've got satellites. We've got the ability to see all around the world what's going on via the mass media. But the Israelis, not only are they killing journalists in Gaza, they've also been blocking channels using their influence in Britain. One of the most horrific and extraordinary things that's been happening is the British journalists colluding with the Israeli Defence Force to kill journalists in Gaza, which is pointed out by Richard Saunders at Double Down News here in Britain, where the Israelis say, such and such journalist is working for Hamas and their crew. The British repeat this lie, and then the Israelis think, well, we can get away with killing this person now, so they kill them. And that is how disgusting the media has been here in the West, in complicity with the Israeli Defense Force's plans to murder journalists, deliberately commit, obviously, horrifying war crimes in a cynical battle to just simply control what people are able to see and to suppress and censor their own war crimes.
Well, the civilian death toll in Gaza continues to rise as Israeli forces press ahead with their blatant violations of the ceasefire agreement. Half a dozen Palestinians were injured by Israeli forces' live fire on Tuesday, while two new bodies were recovered from under the rubble. The total number of civilian fatalities since the beginning of the ceasefire now surpasses 390. The overall death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 is near 70,670, with more than 171,150 others injured. Meanwhile, civil defense teams continue to recover more bodies trapped under the rubble despite extremely difficult conditions on the ground. Gaza officials say they're working with very limited equipment, including a single bulldozer and excavator. Humanitarian conditions are also deteriorating across Gaza amid harsh winter weather and torrential rain. Severe storm has so far caused several buildings to collapse on their residents, including in Gaza City, causing injuries. Our Gaza correspondent, Motiabu Mosabe, joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's truce violations and worsening humanitarian conditions across the war-torn territory. Let's take a listen.
According to the last update from the Gaza Health Ministry, two Palestinian civilians were confirmed dead after the Israeli occupation forces opened the gunfire towards them in the eastern side of Gaza City. The Israeli army claimed once again that those Palestinian civilians crossed the yellow line in the eastern side of Gaza Strip. And as you know, this is still the same lame excuse used by the Israeli regime to justify these repetitive and frequent crimes against the Palestinian people. At the same time, the Israeli tanks opened the gunfire towards the Palestinian people in the eastern side of Gaza City, juxtaposed with the extensive artillery strikes targeting the eastern side of Khan Yunis City. And we are talking about at least 100 displacement camps that were completely overwhelmed and overflooded with the heavy rainfall right now in Gaza Strip. So the Palestinian people are living their most disastrous conditions and circumstances right now in Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, at this moment, the Palestinian people are unable to get any access to the mobile homes or any proper shelters. And this is why what's happening right now is absolutely the normal result of this ongoing policy of the procrastination when it comes to the to allowing for more humanitarian supplies into Gaza Strip.
Well, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised the alarm over new Israeli demolition orders for Palestinian structures in the refugee camps located in northern West Bank. UNRWA said by issuing such orders, Israeli forces seek to enable their long-term control over the camps and permanently alter their topography. UNRWA's statement came after new demolition orders were issued for 25 Palestinian structures in the Nur Shams refugee camp. It said satellite imagery shows that 48% of all buildings in the camp have already been damaged or destroyed before this latest order. UNRWA added that although these conditions, or these demolitions rather, are justified under the pretext of so-called military necessity, they do not make anyone safer. The organization stressed that the forced displacement of over 32,000 Palestinian refugees in the northern part of the occupied West Bank must not become permanent. It emphasized that residents of camps have anxiously waited for 11 months to return home, but the hope fades with every strike of the bulldozers. Our West Bank correspondent, Al Ahmed, joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on Israel's criminal measures across the occupied territory, including new demolition orders for Palestinian structures.
The Israeli forces are intensifying their efforts against the refugee camps and against the UNRWA, especially in the headquarters inside Sheikh Jarrah in occupied Al-Quds, where the Israeli forces last week raided the headquarters and raised the Israeli flag on top of this international organization. The Palestinians now are preparing themselves for a new demolition wave in New Shams refugee camp in Tulkarem City, where more than 25 homes have received demolishing orders, and today the families have got a special permit to go into their homes to evacuate whatever they need from inside. Of course, these homes that they have not been able to reach for the last 11 months. Another wave of land confiscation and aggression in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, as the Israeli military governor has issued a military order to confiscate more than 1,000 dunams of the land of occupied Jenin from the villages of Ya'bad, Silat al-Zahir, al-Sundukumiyya, and al-Attara. All of these villages have been also under aggression and under systematic settler terror in that area.
Hamas has strongly condemned a new bill approved by one of the Israeli Knesset's committees to ban supply of basic services to facilities run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. The movement said cutting off water and electricity supply to UNRWA facilities represents a dangerous escalation by the regime. It added that the move is part of a systematic criminal campaign by Israel targeting the UN agency. Hamas said the regime seeks to undermine UNRWA's humanitarian role in providing essential services to the Palestinian people, especially refugees. It urged the international community, especially the UN, to stop Israel's systematic targeting of UNRWA. Hamas stressed that UNRWA must be supported to continue its humanitarian mission and help Palestinian refugees, especially amid the unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe caused by the Israeli aggression against Gaza. Israeli rights group B'Tselem and investigative company Index Investigations have conducted a joint investigation on an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Nablus earlier this year. The investigation found that two Palestinian brothers were executed at point-blank range, rejecting the Israeli army's claim of self-defense. A correspondent, Al-Ahmed, revisited the scene of the killing and heard from the victim's family as well.
The morning of June 10th ended in one of the clearest documented executions of this war on the West Bank. Brothers Nidal and Khaled Amira, unarmed, surrounded by soldiers, were shot at close range. A new investigation by B'Tselem and Index Investigation dismantles the Israeli army's narrative of self-defense, showing instead a killing carried out calmly, deliberately, and with full control of the scene.
Talking about one martyr is painful, so how do I speak about two? Nidal and Khaled weren't just my brothers, they were my home and my safety. Nidal especially, he was the one who understood me, listened to me, encouraged me in everything.
Despite video evidence and witness accounts, the army insisted the killings were self-defense. But for the Hamira family, no official statement can mask what happened.
Honestly, even without B'Tselem's report, the crime is clear. They were executed in cold blood, hands raised, carrying nothing, surrounded by soldiers. What could they have done? And they didn't just become martyrs, they left a huge emptiness.
As we walked towards the place where they were executed, we felt the mother's grief and pain, a pain that has never erased as the occupation still holds their bodies.
All we want is to recover their bodies. We demand their remains so we can bury them. This is the least of their rights, and our right as well.
Analysts say that the executions persist for one simple reason. Israel faces no consequences.
The execution does not need a law, because it is actually being practiced today by Israel, and it will not stop unless Israel is subjected to serious international sanctions to prevent it from this terrible violation of human rights and international law. This is all happening because of lack of international response to these crimes.
Continuous footage of executing Palestinians on the streets, every time more shocking than the other, yet sadly fails to move the world to finally act. Here in this alley in the old city of Nablus, the brothers Nidal and Khaled Amira took their final breath. Their death, like executions in Jenin, Al-Khalil, and other parts of the West Bank, are now documented, verified, undeniable. But documentation alone is not enough. Without international actions, these killings will continue, not as accidents, not as fog of war tragedies, but as deliberate policy that treats Palestinian lives as disposable. Naqa Hamid, Nablus, Occupied West Bank.
The government of Venezuela sent a formal letter to the UN Security Council condemning the United States for committing maritime piracy. The move came after American forces seized a Venezuelan oil shipment in international waters. In the letter to the Security Council's president, Venezuela said U.S. military units forcibly boarded a private vessel on the high seas, subdued and kidnapped its crew, and illegally seized a shipment of Venezuelan oil. The letter stressed that the oil shipment was part of a regular commercial operation that was legitimate and fully complied with international law. Caracas stressed that the incident was not an isolated event, but part of a sustained policy of coercion and aggression by the U.S. that is enforced through unilateral, illegal, and illegitimate coercive measures. It added that the U.S. action was a flagrant violation of the legal regime that is meant to protect freedom of navigation and lawful international trade. Venezuela demanded that the U.S. immediately release the detained crew, return the confiscated oil, and stop interfering in the country's legitimate trade activities. It also urged the Security Council to publicly condemn the act and take measures to prevent piracy from becoming established as an instrument of political coercion. The Iranian foreign minister has met with Russian lawmakers in the State Duma as part of his official visit to Moscow. Abbas Araghchi was hosted by Leonid Slutsky, chairman of the State Duma Committee on International Affairs. During the meeting, bilateral relations, stronger economic ties, and regional issues were discussed. Slutsky, for his part, praised the increase in bilateral trade and emphasized Moscow's determination to further develop relations with Iran on multiple fronts. The top Iranian diplomat is also scheduled to hold talks with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, on Wednesday. Arachi is in Moscow now following his visit of Minsk, where he met with top Belarusian officials, including President Alexander Lukashenko.
What good can ever come from American sanctions? Part of the answer now unfolding during Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's three-day official visit to Belarus and Russia, a trip that underscores growing ties among countries facing similar pressure. The dynamic on display in Minsk, where Araghchi held high-level talks with senior Belarusian officials. The two sides signed agreements aimed at expanding cooperation and further strengthening already close ties. Officials from both countries say mounting external pressure has accelerated coordination across political and economic fronts. Abbas Araghchi expressed gratitude that Belarus had demonstrated solidarity with Iran during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country. However, the talks were not limited to political stances and international affairs.
Our economic cooperation is extensive and spans across multiple sectors. However, it's insufficient, and both sides are committed to expanding collaboration in trade, investment, and joint production. For example, Iran is a major customer of Belarus's potash, and it was decided today to further facilitate this cooperation.
As part of his visit, Araghchi paid homage to the Belarusian victims of World War II at Minsk Victory Square, a gesture highlighting shared experiences of hardship, now echoed in what both countries describe as an ongoing economic war driven by sanctions. These meetings are seen as yet another step in strengthening friendly ties, with Iran's top diplomat pushing forward cooperation in various political, economic, and regional fronts. Maryam Azatcher, Minsk.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The best parts, impactful dialogues
from the most influential movies of the world.
The 2009 film Angels and Demons is a mystery thriller directed by Ron Howard and based on the novel by Dan Brown. It stars Tom Hanks as Robert Langdon, zombologist, and is considered the first adventure film after the Da Vinci Code. The movie's premise involves religious themes and symbols aligning with the Brown's characteristic style. Robert, a zombologist, tries his best to stop a secret society from destroying the Vatican City. He seeks to decipher various clues in the process, most of which led him to the four altars of science. Now, let's take a listen to a part of this movie.
The swim might help your jet lag.
I beg your pardon?
The bag's under your eyes. It's 5 a.m. and you're from the Vatican. Cross keys under the triregnum. It's a papal symbol.
Claudio Vincenzi, Corpo della Gendarmeria Vaticano.
Vatican police? I was expecting another letter. My request for access to your archives. Shouldn't you be in Rome? Kind of busy time for you guys.
In fact, I was in New York, detailed to the UN. I received a phone call in the middle of the night. Find Professor Robert Langdon. A matter of great urgency. They said, show you this. The Illuminati, they disappeared hundreds of years ago.
Did they? Look at that again. It's an ambigram. It's the same image, forward and backward. Now, that's common for a symbol like a yin and yang or a swastika,
but that's a word.
That Illuminati ambigrammatic symbol has been considered a myth for 400 years. Supposedly in the 16th century, some artist created it as a tribute to Galileo's love of symmetry. It was only going to be revealed when the Illuminati had amassed enough power to resurface and carry out their final goal. I wrote a book about it. Which is why you're here.
The Art of the Illuminati by Robert Langdon.
Part one. Haven't been able to finish part two because I'm not allowed access to your archives.
That's remarkable. Singular. Someone is trying to make you believe the Illuminati themselves have returned to Rome right after the death of a pope.
Four cardinals were kidnapped from their quarters inside the Vatican sometime between 3 and 5 a.m. this morning. Shortly afterward, that document was sent to the office of the Swiss Guard, along with the threat the cardinals will be publicly executed one per hour beginning at 8 p.m. tonight in Rome.
Conclave
was to begin today. We've postponed its start for a few hours, a story of illness. There are no suspicions.
What do you want from me?
These criminals who sent this ambigram meant it as a taunt, a provocation. But Captain Olivetti think if you can use it to learn their identity, perhaps we can stop this abomination.
Why me?
Your expertise, your erudition, your recent involvement with certain church, shall we say, mysteries?
I wasn't under the impression that episode had endeared me to the Vatican.
Oh, it didn't. But it did make you formidable.
Formidable?
A Vatican jet is standing by 20 minutes from here. Will you come with me? Professor Lang, you spent your life searching for symbols like the one you now hold in your hand. How much longer are we going to pretend you have not already decided to come?
If the Illuminati have returned and are in Rome, we will hunt them down and kill them.
The Illuminati did not become violent until the 17th century. Their name means the Enlightenment. They were physicists, mathematicians, astronomers. They were concerned with the church's inaccurate teaching, and they were dedicated to scientific truth. The Vatican didn't like that. So the church began to, how did you say it? Oh, hunt them down and kill them. Drove them underground into a secret society.
Listening to a part of the movie Angels and Demons, directed by Ron Howard, released in 2009.
Thank you.
for joining us. Hebrew media, through its commentators and analysts, has discussed the Sydney attack against the Jewish holiday celebration, the complications facing the second phase of the Gaza agreement, the settlement movement in the Strip, the anticipated meeting between Trump and Netanyahu, and the Israeli escalation against Syria and Lebanon. These topics will be the center of discussion in today's episode with Mr. Ridwan Rizq, political analyst, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome,
Good
Mr.
Morning.
Ridwan. The Sydney attack, in which 16 people were killed and which targeted a gathering celebrating the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, received significant attention in Hebrew media, reflecting the horror and magnitude of the operation. How can the Israeli political exploitation of the Sydney attack be understood today, Mr. Ridwan, and also the campaign that is launched, whether by politicians or even security officials, against the Australian authorities, accusing them of negligence towards the Jews?
Well, this is not true at all, because my personal information about the center that was attacked was one of the major, the main center of the Jewish community in Australia, and that has played a very important role in gathering or collecting, you know, fundraising for the IDF in Israel. And at the same time, that the influence of this center on the Australian politicians and political life is so effective and so goes back a long, long time in the Australian life. This is not the main question. The main question is to be raised and asked that some of the information were leaked about the attackers. One of them was served during Gaza war in the IDF forces against Gaza. Despite the, his nationality, if he's Australian or from Pakistani's origin, why was he serving in the IDF during Gaza war? Why did he do this attack? I believe the you know the answer about the, these questions, because the you know the main public opinion in Australia has turned against the Israelis.
And that's this, why Netanyahu faced the accusations directly to the Australian authorities.
Exactly, so that he is trying to defend or to gain back that's the Australian public opinion to support the IDF or the Israeli government in its acts, genocides in Gaza. Because Australians mainly are peaceful people. They are a bit far from what's going around the world. They don't know much about the situation in the Middle East, but you know the massacre that's committed by the Israelis in Gaza,
yes,
that had turned the Australian public opinion against the story of the Jewish or the Israeli government.
So you don't agree that what happened will actually be a major shift in global opinion towards the Israelis?
Well, this is maybe this is one of the main targets that the Israelis are trying to use.
Exploiting.
And exposing themselves as being
victims.
The victims of the these kinds of acts. I can clearly accuse that the Mossad Israelis are behind this massacre, despite the lives of the, you know, lost in the Jewish community.
You mean they were aware of it, or they are behind it?
It's they are behind it, because if we recall back the assassination of the Israeli ambassador in London in 1982, that was used and is accused to launch a major attack of the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. So we are seeing now the similar scenario, the similar stories, which Israel is used to use, despite that they are not aware, they are aware, and they are willing to sacrifice few Jewish lives just to gain back what they have lost after Gaza.
But why choose Australia?
Australia, because for so many reasons, I believe, and it could be somewhere else also. We are going to see some similar acts around the world. Australia, because the security tightness is a bit loose there, because you know crimes there is very low, people and armed control is very tight, so many people cannot just go and buy arms from the shop as in America, and those arms that they have been used by the attackers were not licensed. And they are not fully automatic. They are semi-automatic rifles, and that's why we can we see that the arms they have used did not cause many more casualties. Otherwise, we could have seen much more
yes.
and many more casualties among the.
Do you actually think that Netanyahu might exploit also the Sydney attack to carry out military adventures in the region?
This is the main reason. I think that Netanyahu is trying to find an excuse to launch a major invasion against Lebanon.
And use the Australian attack as a pretext? How do you link this?
This is, it's very linked, because now that he thinks that he will have the full support of the Western world again by exposing them, the Jewish, as the targets, or the civilians, Jewish in Australia and elsewhere, as victims.
Okay, a very important factor also here is that they also accused Iran. Though Iran declined any accusation, they accused of involvement in the attack despite Tehran's condemnation of it. Would they use it as a pretext to launch a war against Iran specifically?
This is the main purpose, because even the mayor of Sydney City was, announced that accused some accusations of Iran. Launched this accusations even before the investigations took place in after the the attack in Sydney. So this is they are trying together all purpose and all means to justify their attacks or launching a major war against Iran and Lebanon.
Okay. Hebrew media also reports have revealed that Tel Aviv is still refusing to begin the second phase before the handover of the body of the last Israeli captive in the Gaza Strip. Do you think that Netanyahu will oppose Trump's idea that was actually conveyed by his own convoy in the United Nations, Mike Waltz, calling to move to the second phase even if the Israeli captive's body is not returned?
Well, before that, Netanyahu, trying to show himself in front of the Israelis or the world that he is so keen on the lives or gaining the body of one of the captives, he should remember that by activating Hannibal Protocol, was responsible for the killing of all the captives, because all the captives were killed by Israeli air raid. And that's what led to almost kill about 80% of the captives. So now he is showing full responsibility and so keen on gaining back the body of one captive remained in
Trump
Gaza.
But Trump opposes that. So what will happen?
I think that we cannot predict. I think that Netanyahu Trump meeting on the 29th of this month will show that who is more powerful in the decisions in that matter. I believe that Netanyahu...
But before that time, Netanyahu will not move with the plan.
I don't think so at all. And I think that Netanyahu is going to America on the 29th to get to inform Trump about his next invasion of Lebanon and taking over or invading the whole Gaza, igniting another war in Gaza also. So, and I think that Netanyahu will succeed in that, and I don't think that Trump will be able to stop him at all, because I believe that Netanyahu is much more powerful in America than Trump himself.
What if the body of the captive killed in Gaza, the Israeli captive, was not found?
There is a very high possibility that they will not be able to find him, even if they want to. So, and I think that Hamas and Islamic Jihad want to find this body, But due to the fact that 10,000 people are still missing in Gaza, it's not only a matter of one captive. 10,000 people still considered missing under the rebels of the air raids of, you know, committed by the Israeli Air Force. So how can they, how can, if they are, you know, it's very similar that you are just searching for a needle in a you know, a trash a camp in this way. So
do you think that Netanyahu is using this as a pretext?
Of course.
Hamas not finding the body of the captive that was killed by the Israeli shelling?
That was killed by the Israeli shelling, and maybe this one of the attacks could have, you know, shattered even the body. It cannot find even the full body of a captive. And that's happened because some of the Palestinians were buried their dead by, you know, pieces of bodies, and not even knowing those pieces to which person, you know, belonged. So they cannot be sure, even if they found a part of the body, they cannot be sure if it's for the captives or not. Because what we know, that most of the people who are armed Hamas or Jihad were guarding those captives, they were killed along with the air raids also. So we don't know what's happened.
Netanyahu's intention, your opinion, is
he is trying his best and desperate to find any excuse
to go back to war
and to continue his plan in the region.
Will he succeed in doing that?
Of course, he will.
Even if Trump opposes him?
Doesn't matter. Trump's opposition for the war in the region will not be that effective on Netanyahu.
Okay, we remain in the Gaza Strip, where one of the leaders of the settler movement revealed that dozens of settlers managed to enter Gaza's territory in order to settle there, and remained inside for more than an hour and a half before the occupation army forced them out. What are the implications of this settler activity?
We must look at it in from all different angles, because we are seeing settlers not only entering Gaza. We have seen settlers entering southern Lebanon, and they are trying to start building settlements there, and southern Syria also. They have took some points where will choose where to build settlements also. So we are dealing here with the doctrine of the Zionism, which is, encouraged the Jewish people, or the racist Jewish people, to have that they believe that they have the right to go anywhere they want in their promised land. So they consider it as their promised land, and it was backed up by being financed. By the settlements organization, and nothing that will stop them at the end if they don't be, come to a point where they know that they are not allowed to go into other territories. They are already occupiers of Palestine,
okay.
And now they want to.
But how would such provocative act affect the implications of the second phase of the Gaza agreement?
I'm not so, promised that the second phase will take place in Gaza, that will not be implemented at all, because I believe that the war did not stop, and the killing did not stop, and more air raids. Yesterday or the day before, they have assassinated one of the Hamas leaders, Ra'ed Issa, and we know that assassination also continuing in southern Lebanon. Now we are seeing some checkpoints in southern Syria, inside southern Syria, and where they come to very close to the Syrian civil people,
yes,
and they have crossed those checkpoints. So I think this is an invasion all over Gaza, southern Lebanon, and southern Syria.
Okay, the anticipated meeting, however, between Trump and Netanyahu
in Florida later this month is a major topic of discussion in Hebrew media, as it will discuss all the major regional files, according to a former official in the Zionist National Security Council. What do you expect to come out of the Trump Netanyahu meeting that's expected in Florida?
Well, I think that the main purpose behind the Netanyahu visit to America is to inform Trump of his next move and next plan. And I think that we are going to see some escalation in the situation all over the Middle East.
But Trump is the one that called Netanyahu to come.
Well, Trump is in a very squeezed situation because now we are seeing more and more support of Israel among the Congress, and we have seen and watched that one of the congressmen was threatening people or congressmen, other congressmen, from taking any actions against Israel. And that was his threatening in the meaning of threatening their life and their political future or political career. So now it's so obvious that there's a struggle going among the American people, and I think that the Zionist lobby, due to the power of AIPAC and other organizations,
yes,
has lots of power to pressure the President Trump and the White House himself. Because
the power is diminishing, especially after the latest global attack against Israel.
Exactly. So now they are I think they are desperately fighting to keep the American government under the main influence of the American situation to fully support of the Israeli government, because the Israeli government are aware that the public opinion in America is shifting away from full support of Israel.
Okay, but do you think that Trump and Netanyahu see eye to eye on Iran?
Well, I don't think so, because America is trying to avoid into going in a direct confrontation with Iran, because they know that their benefits in the region will be affected so much, especially if the Gulf countries are involved in the attack against Iran. And I think that Iran is not Ukraine, it's not Iraq. Iran is totally a different story, and the Americans are aware that it's going to be a very costly war.
So will this prevent Israel from attacking? A unilateral act, probably.
Maybe, because the Americans have no wish or no will to go into a major war against Iran, because not because of the benefit of Iran, but because they know that the Iran capability on occurring mass destructions to the Israelis, and the Americans in this way, especially Trump and his administration, are trying to protect Israel from itself.
Will they win or succeed in that?
They will try to.
Obviously, they
will
cannot
try
their actions.
They will try to convince Netanyahu that's not on his benefits to start a major war with Iran. They are trying to protect the Israeli from the madness of Netanyahu. I don't think. I doubt that they will succeed in that. But I believe they will try their best.
Okay, Mr. Redouar Rezat, political analyst, thank you very much for joining us in today's episode. It was really nice having you with us on
the
show.
Thanks a lot.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. You should look at Islamic governments and Islamic countries and see in what condition they are in the face of the US, Zionism, the enemy and looters. This results from drifting away from the Quran. If we get close to the Quran, all these voids will be filled and all these rifts will be closed. If this happens, the Islamic identity will show itself in the face of evil-based identity. When we say that if we act on the Quran, life will improve, this is what it means. Quranic concepts exist, but they should be turned into public discourses among people. They should be repeated, worked on, and researched into until they become well-established beliefs in the Islamic community. Poets, literary personalities, and artists should keep writing and doing artistic work on them till they become well-established beliefs in the Islamic community. This is not impossible. This is not improbable. They should not think that if we want to carry out such tasks, it will take 100 years. This is not the case. If those who love Islam and religion show determination, these tasks will be accomplished very soon. We should pursue the Quran like this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Thankfully, in the Islamic Republic, our achievements in getting close to the Quran have not been few in number. We used to be very distant from the Quran. During the time of the Taghuti rule, the Quran was completely isolated in the country. There was no trace of the Quran in our schools, in primary schools and in schools for adults, high schools and universities. There was no trace of the Quran in our society. There were a number of Quranic meetings, but they were rare. We had seen examples of such meetings up close in Tehran, Mashhad, and other cities, and we had heard about similar meetings in other cities. A group of people would gather together, recite the Quran, and that was it. Memorizing the Quran, reciting it in a continuous manner, and promoting Quranic teachings were very rare. However, the revolution helped us get close to the Quran. It familiarized us with the Quran. Today, we are proud that we are interested in and fervent with the Quran. We are proud that our youth are interested in the Quran.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. Give love for me. I wanna
good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week, and the month of Ramadan is the best month of the year. And the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in chapter Al-Qadr. And now we'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with To My Brother. The program examines the universal principles contained in the teachings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and their importance for contemporary individuals and societies. Next up will be Spotlight. This is our final program this hour. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion.